Does it ever feel like you're a marketing professional just
speaking into the void?
Well, with LinkedIn ads, you can know you're reaching the right decision makers. You can even target buyers by job title, industry, company, seniority, skills. Wait, did I say job title yet? Get started today and see how you can avoid the void and reach the right buyers with LinkedIn ads. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Get started at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe, and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of my podcast this week is Caitlin McGregor, co-founder and CEO of Plum.
It was really just about how do you get to that aha moment, and it really has nothing to do with the product and the solution. It was really like the why. Why should you care about Plum? How do we align to a top three boardroom problem? And how do we connect to that strategic problem? And so we were able to get into a strategic conversation with the right people that had the power to decide to do things differently.
This is Caitlin. She co-founded Plum in 2012 and has been an earlier guest on my podcast. She was voted most likely to save the world in her high school yearbook, foreshadowing her future as an innovative entrepreneur. Before founding Plum, Caitlin built two other businesses, which gave her insights into the need for change around talent processes in the age of automation. Fast forward, she was recently selected for the EY Entrepreneurial Winning Woman, North America Class 2024, a program that supports high-potential women entrepreneurs. Caitlin's drive to democratize access to psychometric data so that no one would have to rely on luck for someone to realize their superpower still underpins the core of the company, although how it is brought to market has evolved a lot. And that's noticed. HR Tech voted Plum the best tech intelligence solutions in the market for 2023. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Caitlin back to my podcast. We explored a journey over the past 5 years. How did the market change in general, and in particular in relation to how we attract and manage talent? She also shares what this means to all of us in the coming years. She then drills into how this has changed their priorities around product strategy and go-to-market. And as we discuss this, she reveals some valuable lessons learned in product development, positioning, segmentation, and how her role as a CEO changed in this period of rapid change. And by listening to this podcast, you'll learn four things. Firstly, how Plum expanded from talent acquisition to full employee lifecycle management. Secondly, what made them decide to bet on enterprise instead of SMBs? Thirdly, what internal capabilities organizations need to develop and prioritize to gain competitive advantage and become the winners of the future? And lastly, how her role as a CEO had to change to effectively lead the rapidly growing organization that Plum is today. Well, hi, Caitlin. Thank you for making the time again available for being the guest on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here 5 years later.
Exactly. It's more than 5 years. It was, I looked it up, I think it was February 2019, so 5.5 years. And a lot of things have happened to the company, which is exactly why I reached out, because I like those stories of, okay, what was it then? What is it these days? And what can we learn from that? So I got a couple of questions that I want to go through. And yeah, I mean, if I peel back when we had the interview, The company was, I think, 1 or 2 years old.
And well, we started in 2012, but really spent the first couple of years just trying to figure out the science and the technology and had to kind of rebuild everything from the ground up and relaunched as Plum almost like in 2015. So in that case, it would have been
4 years. Down the road. Yeah, exactly. And it started, I mean, I remember the conversation that you had back then about the cost of making a mistake, hiring the wrong people. And I didn't even realize how big those costs were. So that was already something that stuck here. It was about ditching the credentials-based hiring thing. And you had something completely new for that. Well, 5.5 years down the road, back then you were focused on getting people to ditch that credentials-based hiring. What has changed in terms of the market for hiring in the last 5.5 years?
I think there's a couple of elements that have changed. And I think it's been really helpful because I think in many ways we were ahead of the market and now the market's kind of caught up to what we were trying to do. So when I started Plum, it was because I, as a business owner, I had seen firsthand that cost of a bad hire, $300,000 for a single bad hire, which is when you're starting out, or when you're trying to be conscientious of cost and efficiency, that's a really big expense. And I was exposed to industrial organizational psychology and that there's a whole science and a whole real discipline that understands and has done the research and knows the data that predicts performance, can actually say of these 100 or 1,000 or 5,000 people who are the most likely to outperform their peers and stay longer in the role. And so I think quality of hire is really important now more than ever when companies are under pressure to do more with less. You can't really afford to make a bad hire, but you can't afford to have somebody that's also mediocre in a role. You need everybody to be performing at the highest level of efficiency. So being able to have data to know who are the people that are really going to perform at their best in this role. So quality of hire has become more of an important part of the story, especially as we see generative AI really playing a key role in recruiting where, you know, candidates can apply to 5,000 jobs in their sleep. And so you end up having this massive increase in people applying. So how do you find those quality of hire people? And so really focusing on what we think is the most broken part of the whole process, which is who are you screening into that structured interview? We're not making the final decision, but if you're going to spend your valuable human time interviewing people, are you even interviewing the people that statistically are most likely to be successful? So I think that need has really increased. I think the other thing that's really changed in the market is a lot of companies are going for this skills first approach. There's this recognition that the Ivy League school that you went to, the name brand organization that you worked for, those are not good proxies for understanding quality of hire. And it really leaves out a huge part of the workforce that could be really valuable, especially as the last part, which is retention. You know, we can't hire people and not have it in mind in terms of who's going to actually stay, because it's so costly to onboard people and to upskill them. So much of people's day-to-day jobs is new and changing. You can't just, you know, find somebody that did that job at another company, bring them into your company and assume they're going to do the exact same job. We're seeing that the half-life of hard skills is 2.5 years. So 5 years ago, everyone was trying to find a Ruby on Rails developer. And now nobody cares if you're a Ruby on Rails developer. So how, you know, what else, if we're not looking at all that, you know, past markers of success and we're not looking at where you went to school, you know, what else can we measure on? And so being able to quantify those durable skills, provide objective, measurable data on people's durable skills, their human skills, is more important than ever. So I think that we're in this perfect place now where kind of all these things that I've spent over a decade kind of trying to educate the market and saying that there was science behind this. And it's hard to educate people on the science of performance and the science of productivity. But now I think with such huge changes in the labor force and the types of roles and the changing nature of roles, I think that people are naturally getting to a point where they want the data that Plum provides because they're losing reliable forms of data when people can just chock full their resume full of keywords. People can say whatever they want in those 5,000 applications overnight. So how do you get to those people that you should actually be spending time talking to and interviewing?
Fascinating, because I mean the whole hiring thing has always been this two opposites. If the market is tight, then it's hard to hire people, and if the market is, you know, isn't tight, it's the opposite. But you have always different challenges, and that's where technology can really help. And I completely agree with you. Too many people are based on hired of, you know, where they've been, what they've done, what university they've completed, and so on, rather than do they actually fit in the team. And I've seen in my career also a couple of big mishires, people that on paper look really good, but they were the biggest no-nos. And it brings the whole culture down.
Absolutely. The other part that's been really interesting is that, you know, for years, talent acquisition has had big budgets and has had a lot of opportunity to mature as a practice, really create best-in-class playbooks, really create these processes that have gotten a lot of attention, a lot of investment. And what we've seen since COVID is this real emergence of being able to invest in employees. And I think that's a big change from where we were in 2019 versus now, is that at the very end of 2020, we launched the talent management part of our platform, which is taking the same data that we were using to screen in who you should be interviewing based on durable skills, providing that measurement of durable skills for your employees so that you can look at internal mobility, which I think is a really, you know, that wasn't a hot priority 5 years ago. So being able to put more emphasis on retaining the employees that you have and maximizing the investment you already have made in them and trying to create efficiencies and retain that institutional knowledge and hold on to people. I mean, before, if somebody was at a job for 6 months or a year, they didn't love putting it on their resume. You know, it kind of looked bad. People wanted to show that they were in a place at least 2 years, if not three. Yeah. Whereas now, you know, people will put in 6 months or a year on their resume. Like, there isn't this honor code to have people stick around, and the expectations from the employees are so much higher in that they don't want to stay in a job where they're not being respected and they don't have an opportunity to grow. So companies are under pressure to put more emphasis on maximizing and creating efficiency and productivity with the people that they do have. And so being able to understand the transferable soft skills, those durable skills of your existing workforce, being able to identify future leaders so that you're creating the right bench strength of future leaders. For us, it's all one data set. Doesn't matter if it's a candidate or an employee, but the functionality of being able to have a universal assessment across your entire organization is something that I know when we kind of first pitched it 4 years ago, people were like, this is great, but like, I don't know what to do with it. Whereas now people are like, this is exactly what we need. We need, again, this objective data on everybody and just those concepts of like investing in your people and maximizing how you're placing people in the right roles. It's not just about the external candidates anymore. It's also about do you have the right people in the right seats inside your own organization?
Exactly.
And that's been another big change.
So there's a couple of these big changes. You just highlighted them in a nice order. You already mentioned something, and I want to dig into that a little later about the product expansion. But has this change also led to other ways of, okay, maybe the division has changed, maybe that your ambitions have moved in a little different direction? What has that meant to your strategic direction?
Yeah, I think that there's two big impacts. One is that we started with SMBs, small, medium-sized businesses, because we know how critical that single mishire is. We know, you know, as somebody that ran businesses before starting my own, you know, once you have this data on who are your most innovative people or who are your candidates that are best at execution, you know, who are the ones that are going to outperform others. Once you have this data, it's like putting on a pair of glasses. And as a business owner, having a pair of glasses is a real competitive advantage over those business owners that don't have it. So we started with SMBs right at the beginning. But the problem is that SMBs, if their business isn't going well, which a lot of SMBs, it doesn't, then they stop hiring. So we were experiencing a lot of people that would stop using Plum, but then they'd come back a year later when they'd start hiring again. So it wasn't that they didn't love it. They did. It's just if they weren't using it, they couldn't afford to keep paying an annual subscription. So we just realized that SMBs, and there was so much, while they were a clean slate and it was easier in some ways for change management, they some of them just didn't have the basics like payroll in place and like very, very basic. So while we still have lots of SMB customers, it wasn't the right go-to-market for us. It wasn't the right area to focus on, even though this definitely scales and is helpful and critical. And like I said, we still have SMBs, but it wasn't the place to put all of our energy in terms of marketing and sales. And, you know, companies between 500 to 1,000 are in this really weird teenager stage, which is, I now have a teenager, like it's an awkward stage. So we were like, that's not the best place either to focus all of our energy and time. And about 5 years ago, we started winning some really big enterprise accounts and having really great success with enterprise. And at the end of the day, this is a data play. You know, this is, do you have the most predictive data on performance on all of your employees and all of your candidates? And enterprises have the most candidates and they have the most employees. And so it was the place where we could provide the absolutely undeniable, you know, strongest ROI. It's also where we could differentiate. There's lots of legacy assessment companies, and legacy psychometric assessment companies typically are very siloed. You know, they'll focus just on high volume roles or just on identifying leadership potential for directors and above, or just, you know, focusing on teamwork for existing teams. And they're all separate siloed assessments. And it's a horrible user experience because every time you want to use the data for a new case, you have to retake it. So the fact that we had one universal assessment that works for everybody, and then you slice and dice the data to see the different outcomes in different ways, and it's all automated, we could really differentiate in the scale in a way that our competition couldn't.
Let me make a small interruption here. Caitlin just made an excellent remark about finding their sweet spot in enterprise accounts. It wasn't about features or functions, i.e. what they offered. Others could offer the same. It was about how they solved a highly valuable and critical problem in a way others simply couldn't. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. They focus on the essence, acknowledge that they cannot please everyone, and then create new value capabilities in a way that's different, not just better. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So we have this incredible user experience where people even organically will come to our website and complete their Plum profile, and they share their results by the minute on LinkedIn saying, you know, thank you for helping me be seen for not just what I've done, but my potential in terms of what I could do if given the opportunity. And thank you for helping me understand how I can develop myself. Mm-hmm. And thank you for helping me, you know, look at different career opportunities. These are all things that we provide for free to the individual. And so, you know, it was really interesting when we could see that we had this great user experience and we could do it at scale, that just enterprise was the right fit. So really focusing on going to market with enterprise was a big shift in the last 5 years, and definitely impacts our strategy, because what you decide to develop, you know, APIs become more important rather than adding a status quo feature that you could already get in Workday or SAP. We complement, we're an addition. We're that one assessment that can replace all of your assessments. We're that one way in your skills first approach to have durable skills. So it changes your roadmap. And then the other thing with enterprise, and this is the same for all businesses, but we see it kind of being a really big pain point with enterprise, is the role company culture plays. Every single company, the executive team is under enormous pressure to come up with a transformative strategy to help them future-proof their organization and stay competitive and get ahead. And, you know, strategy is how you move the company from where it is today to ideally where you want it to go. And what we're seeing is that the more ambitious the strategy and the more transformational the strategy, often there's a disconnect between what is the reality happening today And is there awareness of where there's already buy-in in the organization to support this new strategy? And where is there a big disconnect between, like, that's great that leadership wants to go in this direction, but nobody else is bought in. And so we can provide in just 7 minutes understanding from every single employee, from leaders to managers to individual contributors to different regions to different parts of the business that may have been bought and then merged together. Where is their buy-in to this new strategy and where is their resistance? Because if everybody's rowing in the same direction towards the new company strategy, then you're going to be fast and efficient and you're going to get there quickly and beat the competition and you're going to be successful. But if everybody's rowing in different directions and there's a lot of resistance to this change, you're going to experience so much friction, so much internal change management needs that you're going to be slow and inefficient. And so providing data on your company culture so that you can align it to executing your company strategy and then empowering individuals to use this data to help then develop people towards where you're trying to go. But also identify, you know, there's this great concept, you know, crossing the chasm about early adopters. And when you're going to market, you know, a lot of companies, you're going after those early adopters and then you get your fast followers. And then after the fast followers are on board, then you can go to the laggards or the late adopters. Well, inside of our organizations, we have the same phenomenon. As you have a new strategy, who are those that are going to be your early adopters? They're going to be excited by the strategy. They're going to want to execute it first versus who are those laggards, those late adopters that are going to be really struggling with such a huge change in direction. And frankly, you can run sandpaper across the entire organization trying to get everybody smooth and on board, or you can take advantage of identifying those early adopters or those culture champions that naturally are driven by what you're trying to get done, and they can lead the way and show success so that it gives comfort and reduces the fear and anxiety of the others. And then you can get everybody going towards company culture. So I think from a strategic standpoint, recognizing that culture is an X multiplier, it is the environment. If you have the right people in the right seats, but you don't have the right environment to set them up for success, it's a big waste. But if you can give them an environment where they're going to be aligned and set up for success towards executing your company strategy, then you're just going to get so much more of a return. And it's, again, identifying this space where data is missing. And by having that data, companies can be so much more successful and efficient and really save time and money by avoiding kind of the surprises when you try to execute a strategy. And then you're like, oh, wait a second. It's not, I'm getting all of this pushback. We can be that roadmap for your internal change management in advance before you hit those roadblocks.
So is this only about finding out internally whether people are buying in or in resistance to a strategic change? Or is it maybe even more about whether you have what it takes, durable skills wise, to make a successful move transition from A to B?
It's a combination of both. So one is it's really helpful to know where you're trying to go. Again, that strategy, and is there a buy-in for it or not? So for example, there's a great statistic showing that CEOs of banks believe that the adoption of generative AI into the day-to-day workforce is going to be a massive differentiator and a competitive advantage, that it's a must, which is really interesting because, you know, one of our customers that's a bank doesn't allow people to use generative AI. So I don't think this is necessarily all CEOs, but there's one article that came out talking about this. So let's say that you're a company who wants to embrace generative AI and you think that it's mission critical for the new strategy. So do you have people in your organization that believe that that's the right strategy moving forward? Like, are people even on board, or do you have to go back to like convincing them? Well, if they're already on board, you can skip over a lot of trying to convince people and just go into, okay, how are we making this actionable? Kind of full steam ahead. But then it's about, okay, do I have leaders that are going to feel comfortable and excited about adopting generative AI? Well, in your executive team, you know, how many of your leaders are naturally driven by innovation? Yeah. You know, that gets them out of bed in the morning. They're excited by being able to think outside the box and do things differently. Because if you don't have enough executives that are excited by the possibility of using this technology, then they're not going to be able to model it. And then same thing, when you get into your managers, are your managers going to be nervous about using the technology or resistant, or is it going to be something that like retains them into your company because this is a really exciting opportunity and they want to take advantage of it? And then when you get into your individual contributors, so you don't need everybody to be innovative. You just need enough of those kind of examples to lead the charge. And, you know, you can look in your organization and say, do we have like what percentage of people, you know, actually are driven by innovation as something that they're exceptional in across the organization? As we open up hiring again, do we need to emphasize those durable skills more than others? It's, you know, a lot of people are thinking about generative AI in terms of a hard skills training. And while it's, you know, helpful, the reality is this is like smartphones. You know, the more you use it as a native user, the more you're going to gain the efficiencies. So it's really about providing the space and the projects and the opportunities to learn how to incorporate this technology in your day-to-day life. And are you providing the tools? You know, everybody in my organization, we pay for ChatGPT, the premium version, Teams. So, you know, everyone has access to the latest models through ChatGPT. Some companies are investing in Microsoft 365. Our developers all have GitHub Copilot, which has been a huge boost in productivity. So I think it's a combination of what are you trying to accomplish? We have other customers that are using the culture data when they're trying to merge two departments together. So a lot of our companies have gone through mergers and acquisitions. So they have, you know, two different companies and they're trying to bring them together. Well, understanding the unique culture of each of those departments or companies, and then understanding ideally where those people want to go, where's the similarities, where's the differences? And then if you're trying to create this one team, it may be who are your individual contributors who are driven by teamwork, because they're naturally going to want to bridge the divide between these different groups. If you're combining them, they'll naturally be bridge builders and find that cohesion. So do you have enough people in this new makeup that are in a place where they can utilize that teamwork? Is there a new employee committee they could be part of? Is there a budget to do virtual get-togethers? So I think it's a combination of what are you trying to accomplish and then who are the people that will run towards that goal the fastest.
Exactly. Yeah, that is critical. And I mean, that's also how I understood Plum, like what its differentiation was in the beginning and how you can actually further scale that. So what I actually understood from what you just said in terms of the changes in the market, the strategic moves that as a company you started to kind of move around, the product has evolved from just talent acquisition to, if I call it right, like following the whole employee life cycle.
Yes.
What has that done to how you manage the product on a day-to-day basis? I mean, what has it done to your product team? And what have you learned from that? Because it's a pretty big expansion.
I mean, some of the really cool things that happened on the product side was the learning journey that we had to go through. We started with a book that was written by 37 Signals, which are the creators of Bootcamp. And, you know, they had a really great book on kind of modern product development practices, where they basically said the way to develop really great product is you need to have somebody from design, somebody from product, and somebody from engineering on a team. And that team basically will figure out how to execute on new product. And it was a really different way of thinking, because if you talk to product leaders, again, like 5-6 years ago, how product used to get designed in a lot of companies was product would go off, talk to customers, envision something, and then they would kind of throw this concept over the fence for engineering to catch. And then engineering would go off and build it on their side of the fence. And then when it was ready to get deployed, they'd be like this reveal of, hey, here's the finished product. And product would go, what's that? That's not what we talked about. And there would be this kind of disconnect where it was happening. Basically, everybody was on their own side of the fence. And throwing things over, and it wasn't a bit of a broken telephone. The end result wasn't really landing. And so the idea of removing that fence, collaborating from the get-go and bringing design from that UX, you know, you want the user ultimately to use the product, to involve them from day one. It was just a different concept. But, you know, and I think a lot of companies have moved in this direction. It's not as new now. But what we had to figure out is a lot of these books on, you know, how to do great customer discovery, which was really great. And all these different, like, there was no book that kind of had an end-to-end process. We had to go and find all of these different books that specialized in a very specific part of the process, like customer discovery, customer feedback. And then we had to piece it together, but then we had to right size it to reflect the size of company that we are. And then we had to right size it to reflect the fact that we were dealing with enterprise that have very different expectations than an SMB. With SMBs, you can add a feature every other week. With enterprise, they can't have you changing things every other week. That doesn't work from trying to enable an entire group of people to do the same thing over and over again. You actually need stability with your product at the enterprise level. So it was just, it was very interesting in that there wasn't a perfect design playbook for small companies addressing enterprise size deals, and that we didn't have to go up against legacy practices. We really could design from the ground up best practices. And so it was a journey of piecing it all together. And what's been great about it, though, is that for us, it's not about a whole bunch of different feature sets. It's all the same data on people. Yeah. It's the human behind the work. Once you understand what gets somebody out of bed in the morning, excited about the work they're going to do, what naturally motivates them to excel in a role, and how to match them to a role that's going to use those strengths on a daily basis, the product is really just about revealing the data in different lights. It's not as complicated to expand the platform, because the core data is what is propelling the whole thing. And we're not trying to get into, you know, a feature set war, because we're always married with that core, you know, ATS or the core HRIS. Like, we don't have to get into kind of the mundane feature sets. We're really just focusing on being the absolute best enterprise grade, scalable psychometric assessment, you know. But it's also allowed us to look at, you know, are there other pieces of data that are helpful to include? So in May, we doubled down. Sorry, go ahead.
What did you learn there? What are these? If you look in hindsight right now, what happened in the last 2-3 years, what has been the biggest revelation?
One is that the future of HR is individual led, meaning that, you know, right now, a lot of the programs are top down led by HR people that are implementing HR programs. And really, the way to empower your people is to empower them to be the CEOs of their own career development, even candidates, empowering them to not spam every single job, but to really help them understand which jobs are the ones where they're going to be the happiest and most fulfilled and to flourish in their career. So everything is about, how do you focus on empowering the individual to take some of that burden off of HR and really empower somebody to take control of their career? So that bottoms-up approach, which you very rarely see in technology solutions in the HR tech space. I think you see that more business to consumer type of approach in other types of products. So I think long term, we're doing our best, but I don't think the market has fully caught up. I think that the solutions of the future will be bottoms up, driven by the individual. So really investing in our experience for employees and candidates. So we launched Plum Flourish, which is really about that career management platform for the individual. And it's totally free for the individual, and it carries with them throughout their career. So when they finish their 20-25 minute one-time Plum profile, they then get access to all this data on what makes them exceptional, how to communicate, what really differentiates them and makes them exceptional, and what opportunities of different careers that would be a good fit, or how to develop compensatory strategies for areas that are really draining that could lead to burnout. So all of that, really doubling down on that value to the individual.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that we have learned, and I think we knew this the entire time for the last decade, it was, as much as you can talk about durable skills, people always, always will say, okay, but, you know, that's great. They have the potential to be fantastic as a financial analyst, but do they have any background in finance? You know, that's great that this person could be really good as a chief operating officer, but do they have any management experience? Like, there's bare minimum qualifications, bare minimum eligibility that if we say this person's in the top third percentile of the entire workforce for how likely they are to outperform their peers in this role, people still want to know that they meet a bare minimum amount of eligibility to be screened in for that structured interview.
Yeah, sure.
Now, what changes is that if they're a 95 match and they have 5 years of experience and the role wanted them to have 8 years of experience, often the 95 match is getting that structured interview. And that's what's supposed to happen. But people still need a bare minimum. And what we found is that that's often about five pieces of data or less. It's not about understanding every keyword or every grain of sand on the beach. It's a very basic set of, okay, if they're a 95, should I interview them or not? Okay, do they have these bare minimum levels of experience? Are they an individual contributor? Are they a manager? Have they been in finance before? And so we incorporated in May the ability to also have this work profile data or, you know, experience data that helps people just quickly shortlist who is eligible for that structured interview. And that's really the holy grail, is understanding not only the durable skills, but also that bare minimum eligibility to get them in that structured interview. And we have that plus the kind of the culture data to know if they're going to be set up for success. So it's kind of this trifecta of data that really, I think, solves what companies are trying to figure out, which is how to be skills first, how to be efficient and productive and cost effective. By providing this data, it allows them to have objective, actionable data to execute on these really important objectives that companies are going towards right now.
Perfect. The missing piece at the end. A couple of questions more, because I was looking at the time. In this process of the last 5.5 years, I mean, what I found is that you did two rounds, about $8 million of Canadian dollars. And of course, that was about scaling the business. So if you look at that journey of scaling the business, what has been the biggest learning you took from there? What was easier than expected, and what was supposed to be harder than expected?
I mean, I think the biggest transition for me was when we were in the early days. A big value that I provided as a CEO in terms of leveraging my skills, strengths, was being somebody that can roll up my sleeves and problem solve in the moment. And I really emphasized having the maturity, especially since we had to focus on enterprise, like the maturity of our own operations, the maturity of our own company systems, and just building a really solid, good business that could handle kind of all the security and compliance needs of enterprises, and making sure that our own system and processes and people don't crumble under the pressure of enterprise needs. Like, just building a really, really, really strong foundation was, you know, my background was really coming up the operations side of the business. I was a VP of operations, and then I was a president, but everything before becoming the CEO and co-founder of Plum, and everything was really about ensuring that the operations were rock solid. And that was rolling up my sleeves and really contributing towards it. And what I really learned in the last 5 years is that a lot of successful CEOs are sales CEOs. They're coming into those enterprise deals, giving confidence to the customer that they're going to be a priority, that we aren't going anywhere. We're going to be here for the long haul to make sure that they're successful and that we are really committed to their success. And there's nothing more powerful than hearing that directly from the CEO. So I had the opportunity to get more and more involved on the sales side of things. And it was hard at first because it I didn't feel like it came naturally. I felt that it's really hard because so much of sales is getting through all the no's before you get to the yeses. Exactly. And I found that that was really hard on me to be in those meetings where, you know, this is my baby. And, you know, a certain portion of the pitches, they're going to tell you that your baby's ugly. And that was really hard. But slowly over time, that ratio started changing where that became the rare case that people were calling the baby ugly. And the majority of the time people were saying, wow, this is exactly what I need. And I didn't even know this existed. But now that I do, I want to go. And so it became really, really rewarding. And I got better at it because I learned a lot, especially from Jason Putnam, who's our chief revenue officer. He came in and really partnered with me and taught me how to sell by going into these meetings together and leveraging our different strengths and going through the process where I saw so much success that I now know what good looks like. And it helped me really develop my sales muscle. So being able to kind of still have the foundation of being an operational CEO, but now also sales CEO, it's something that I wish I understood so much earlier in our journey. Is I think I could have contributed all the hours that I put into fundraising or getting grants. If I had put into sales, we probably would have been farther along from a sales perspective earlier. So that I think was a huge, huge takeaway for me. And then the other part is just because we believe that when people flourish, business thrives. And that's our tagline. And we have to emulate that inside our own organization first. We have to drink our own champagne. So we, for a long time, obviously, you know, have always used our own product to help hire and develop and promote internally our own people. But it's the culture aspect of how do you get everybody rowing in the same direction? And how do you get that alignment? And I really believe that, you know, chief executive officer is probably not the right title for most CEOs. I really feel like it's chief alignment officer.
Yeah.
And really understanding how to find and nurture and consistently maintain alignment while your organization is rapidly changing and the economy and the environment and customers, like we're constantly growing and changing, but how do you create that consistent alignment throughout the organization? That to me is the biggest muscle. And there's so many people that contributed to creating the culture that allows for us to have that continual alignment through change. And I had to do a lot of work on recognizing that early days, I was very focused on the tasks that needed to be accomplished. I mean, you hear a lot about accountability, you know, are people doing what they say they're going to do? And a lot of leadership is run through an accountability model. I'm going to tell you that, you know, these are the goals, and then did you execute on them? Yeah. And what we realized is that sometimes people can't accomplish the goals they set out to do because another department came along and asked them to utilize their valuable resources to accomplish something else. And you can't do both. And so how do we create an environment where everybody wants to collaborate to get the most important things done? And it doesn't end up becoming a hoarding of resources to accomplish the goal that I'm being measured against, because if I don't accomplish my goal, I'm going to look bad, and I don't care about your goal. That's not my goal. That's your goal. So we had some siloing, we had some hoarding of resources. And when you're smaller, that can be the end of productivity. And, and so really figuring out how to have a collaborative set of goals and culture, and that's where the alignment comes from, is are we committed to the outcome that we collectively have to contribute towards? And the only way we're going to get there is if we are not in separate boats rowing in different directions, but are in one boat all rowing in the same direction. And that took years to figure out. Sometimes I look back and I feel bad about the CEO that, you know, somebody that worked at our company 8 years ago, you know, they would have seen somebody blinded by the tasks that needed to be accomplished and spending so much time on executing on those tasks that I missed the mark on recognizing that my job was to lead and to connect on, you know, what do you need as a human? What do you need in your role? How can I help set you up for success? What do you need more of, less of, you know, really putting the people and the alignment of our common objective first, and the accomplishing of the task, if it's set up properly, will naturally happen. If you have the right people in the right roles, it will naturally happen. Yeah. So how do we make sure that people are set up for success, full stop? And if you have everybody set up for success, then I'm doing the right job as a CEO. So it's balancing that and then being in front of customers and growing sales. And so those to me are the personal lessons that I've taken away and have really benefited from learning.
I've heard so much of this, and also particularly after COVID. I remember a call that I had with the CEO of a company called Seneta in Norway. We said exactly the same. Burst silos during COVID, cut the silos, and things started to move. No more managing top down, but giving people the goal. Say, okay, I'm here to help you figure it out and work with everybody that you need to accomplish the goal. And it's getting people with their nose in the same direction. I remember it was a Radhika Dutt who wrote the book, Radical Thinking. That's the mm-hmm. book. She said, and that's also what I recognize from my time at Unit 4, that everybody's always going at full speed, but in different directions. And it's not about speed, it's about creating velocity in the same direction. And if you align everybody to go with the same speed that they normally are going, but in that same direction, that is massive for an organization. And I think you accomplished that. One more question on the before we finish. You said in the beginning when you were in those sales calls, sometimes you got this argument of the ugly baby. And I completely recognize that. And at some point, it started to get less and less. Was that because you got better at qualifying, like really understanding who is your dream customer and what defines them? Or was it about adjusting the product in the meantime so that it wasn't that ugly duck for the people that initially thought it was?
That is such a great question, because the answer, if I was to go back in time and tell myself what the answer was, would have shocked me.
Yeah.
So 12 months ago, I saw the best example of this. And we're working on, how does it resonate? How do we find that aha moment again? And I think we have it. But 12 months ago, it was crystal clear. The market's changed, so it doesn't resonate the same way. But 12 months ago, when we talked to customers, they were having a problem where they didn't have enough candidates. Like, there's 3.5 million unfilled cybersecurity roles in the world. Exactly. Like, there just weren't enough people already qualified that had done that job for them to hire from, for example. So our pitch was this metaphor of a leaky bucket, that you can't get enough people coming through that spout to hire. And then at the same time, there's a hole in the bucket where you're losing all of your employees, because this was, mass exodus even up until a year ago. And so, Plum's solution was that we could open up the aperture and screen in all these people that you weren't considering before, and put a hole in that bucket and retain the employees that you need to keep. And that was it. I didn't need to talk about the science, how, we are beating out the most valid psychometric assessment companies that you can think of, that we have the highest science. I didn't have to talk about the user experience. I didn't have to talk about the scalability. I just had to say, you are struggling in the boardroom right now because you don't have enough of the right people to continually grow. We have banks that couldn't open branches because they couldn't find enough people to work in the branches. So it was really just about, how do you get to that aha moment? And it really has nothing to do with the product and the solution. It was really like the why. Why should you care about Plum? How do we align to a top 3 boardroom problem? And how do we connect to that strategic problem? And what would happen is somebody would have been given a mandate to maybe go and find a psychometric assessment, to assess for durable skills. But when we would talk to them, we're like, that's great, but what are you trying to accomplish? And we talk about the leaky bucket, and they go, that's what my boss or my boss's boss has been talking about. And we say, okay, go get your VP of talent acquisition, VP of talent management, your CHRO, and bring them on the next call. And so we were able to get into a strategic conversation with the right people that had the power to decide to do things differently. And Now we talk about the pace paradox and how, you know, there's so much change that companies are going through. The amount of change that companies went through between 2000 and 2004, that same amount of change over 5 years is happening now in just a single year. In 2024, we're seeing that same amount of change. And 20 years from now, you're going to see, you know, the amount of change that we're experiencing a year in a matter of months, if not weeks. And so how are companies keeping up? Well, they're creating these transformational strategies. Well, do they have data on if their company's aligned? No. Okay. We can do that. And every single employee, you can have a Plum profile, gift it to them. And now you have your workforce data. So we can connect the macro data with the micro data in terms of how to transform your organization. And so it used to always be about we had the best science. Mm-hmm. And this is why you need to use our data, because it's 4 times more accurate than a resume. I mean, the fact that I'm only saying this now instead of at the beginning of the podcast is it shows how much things have changed. We don't, we are not trying to convince people based on science, which frankly would oftentimes make them feel like, well, I don't have a PhD in industrial organizational psychology. How am I going to turn around and tell the organization why this is important? Like, we made our customers feel dumb half the time because it was so, so academic. So I think it was about getting the right aha moments as to the why you should care.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, glad to hear that. Glad you figured that part out, because it's the key to that growth that you're looking for. Really, really good. So, well, last question. What, after this 5.5 year journey since our last podcast, based on all the knowledge that you've gained since then, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with other tech entrepreneurs that aspire to grow like you're growing?
Do sales. And I know it sounds funny, but if you're part of like a tech accelerator, tech incubator, you know, we get so much coaching from all these organizations on how to pitch investors, but we're not given sales training or sales support. So the do is more time selling. And the don't is, don't waste time talking to the wrong customer, like really identifying what size of organization and what type of stakeholder that you should be talking to. You can waste a lot of time focusing on the wrong group. And then once you know, you have to align your resources the right way. So, you know, if you're focusing on enterprise, do you have enterprise reps? Do you have enterprise go-to-market? Do you have enterprise marketing? Like, or if it's SMB, does your sales and marketing teams align to that target audience? So don't pick the wrong target audience and don't have the wrong match of revenue resources to align to that.
Perfect advice. Thank you very much. Well, I mean, for people not to have to go back to the previous podcast, where can people go to find out more about Plum and how to say hi to you?
Plum.io, and you can find the ability to complete your own Plum profile right on Plum.io if you'd like. And then if you're looking to find me, I am on LinkedIn, Caitlin McGregor, CEO of Plum. And so I'm happy to connect with you as well. And thank you so much for having me today.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
And this ends my conversation with Caitlin. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Caitlin McGregor, co-founder and CEO of Plum. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.